me pones un ejemplo. Entonces, si tú no quieres hablar conmigo, dímelo para yo no llamarte ni molestarte, porque nada más quedaba tú.
Real talk. Real people. Real stories. The He's Just Podcast. Yeah! Welcome, everyone, to another He's Just Podcast. I'm your host and founder of the He's Just a Social Worker Movement, Jules Duger, with another amazing show for you today. But before we get started, I want to remind everyone that this platform was built because way too often, as people, we were overlooked or labeled. But this is no longer. Our plight and our fight is for anyone and everyone who feels a need to be understood. We are strong as individuals, but unstoppable when we unite. You know, well-being encompasses the holistic state of a person's physical, mental, and emotional health. It's not just the absence of the illness, but also the presence of factors that promote a fulfilling life. This includes aspects like happiness, satisfaction, fulfillment, resilience, and a sense of purpose. Meet Dr. Beth Kirwan, a distinguished clinical psychologist with an impressive career, renowned as a captivated TED talker and public speaker. She offers invaluable insights into the human mind. Beth is also recognized as a skilled mind-body coach and the acclaimed author of 3 award-winning books, Dancing on the Tightrope, The Transformative Power of 10 Minutes, and Gifts of the Rain Puddle. Today, we will learn about her most recent book, You Don't Have to Change Everything. 6 ways to shift your vantage point, stop striving for happy, and find true well-being. Her thoughtfulness and leadership extends to Psychology Today, where she shares her expertise through engaging blogs. Furthermore, she has developed the Innovative Well-Being Toolkit online program designed to empower individuals on the journey to holistic wellness around the world. Dr. Beth Kirwan, welcome to our show.
Thank you so much for having me. It is truly my pleasure to be here tonight.
The pleasure is ours. I mean, let's get started. Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got introduced into this work.
Wow. Well, I guess kind of think how far back to go, but I would say it really started in 11th grade. So I was I had an elective to take at that time in high school, and I chose to take a social psychology class. And as part of that class, we had the opportunity to pair up with a student from middle school and be kind of a mentor to them during that year. And there was something about that experience that really moved me, that I found so fulfilling to be able to be present with and have that kind of connection with somebody else, you know, in a helping role. And at that time, I had just lost my mom. I guess it would have been the year before. When I was 15, my mom died in a car accident. So there was a lot going on for me emotionally at that time. And I share that because I feel like that's kind of part of my journey going forward. That so from 11th grade, I knew that I wanted to go into psychology. It was kind of a straight shot for me. I think that's not always how it works out, but I knew that's what I wanted to do. And I went ahead and pursued, you know, all of my education that led me down that path. But somewhere along the way, I also realized that I really needed to do, you know, more inner work as well, in terms of dealing with my own grief and loss, in terms of just, you know, all our life issues, right, and challenges. I think for me, I was and I am wired more on the high stress, anxious end. So I started turning to, I worked with a number of amazing therapists, but also turning to a lot of mind-body practices. And over the years have really gotten into mindfulness, meditation, and just working with other mind-body strategies that have been so transformative in my own life, and then really this excitement about bringing it into my professional work as well, and seeing the ways that it has been transformative for my patients, my clients. So that is kind of, and I guess I should add to that, that before I knew I wanted to be a psychologist, I actually wanted to be a writer. And when I was very young, and I would write poetry and write little pieces and things like that. And when my daughter went off to college, so my son was at home at that time, but it was the first time in my life where I had a little bit more open space. And so I started writing, and that's when I really wrote my first book and kind of subsequent after that. So I feel like I've been able to weave in these two dreams in my life in some way that have been deeply fulfilling. And so the writing has been a lot of fun for me along the way in recent years.
Thank you for sharing. So lovely. I mean, usually we don't get an opportunity to live out both of our dreams, and you so nicely did that. Let's talk a little bit about mental health. What fascinates you the most about this work?
Oh, gosh. You know, I think there's so much to that question. I think we all struggle. You know, I mean, I guess what I see, and I think especially, so I wrote this last book during the pandemic, but I've having the privilege of sitting in the office space and now virtually, you know, a lot with patients, but really over the past 30 years, what I am able to see from my, you know, seat, if you will, is just this incredible common humanity and how common our humanness is. And I think that not everybody gets to see that, that people who come into my office often feel like, you know, I'm alone, I'm struggling with this, what's wrong with me that I'm feeling this way? There's something wrong with me, there's something missing. And we often feel so isolated and alone in our struggles. And, you know, having sat with people over 30 years and, you know, and I can just see like, you know, this is part of our common humanity. We all touch into some of these struggles, and it's just part of what makes us human. So I think there's, you know, just this piece around mental health of how we accept and embrace all of our emotions and have ways of working with them, and really being able to see that as just something that makes us human, not something that makes us different or separate.
You know, and I shared this with you when we had a brief chat before we started this show. What drew me about you, and sometimes, and most times, I don't really look at, or am I predisposed to think about our guests, to think about, oh, let's see what they've done. And like I mentioned to you, I've had great opportunities to meet a ton of people from around the world, thanks to this platform. But what drew me most about you was that sense of human that you have, that sense of making sure that it's the opposite. People who think or feel that they are struggling with mental health, that represents us. We are worried about the other people who don't report and fail to share that they have mental health. And when I saw you in some of the talks that you've done, I really was taken back about that. And as we learn more about your new book, I can't wait to let our listeners listen to all the great things that you have done to shape this up. But before that, I wanted to talk to you about these changes. And you talked about 30 years in the game and different things that you've been able to do. What do you feel has changed in the realm of mental health and well-being since you've seen these changes happen throughout the years?
So, gosh, a couple things come to mind. When I was in graduate school, there was a big emphasis on what's called psychopathology, you know, which is kind of finding what's wrong and fixing it, if you will. And, you know, to be fair, the way the insurance companies work nowadays, you know, we need to diagnose people in order to, you know, and there's some, and some of that is important and can be quite helpful. But that being said, so this is back at the time when I was in graduate school, I had the good fortune of having a mentor during my internship, Dr. Robert Brooks, and I'll probably talk about him again if I talk about, he influenced especially one of my vantage points that I wrote about in the book. But one of the things that he really emphasized is this idea of working from strength and finding what's right and building upon it. And there was this whole growing movement around this time that really has expanded more in terms of this positive psychology field, in terms of really understanding what makes people thrive, what helps people in terms of really building what I call, refer to as this deep well of well-being within us, you know, that resilience. How do we build that? How do we grow that? So that's been an exciting development that I've seen in the field, that there's been really, you know, an emphasis on that. And I would say the other thing that's been really exciting for me is that there's been a real merging of some of these more mind, body, and even contemplative practices with science. And a lot of evidence-based practices now involve, you know, mindfulness, involve meditation, involve different kinds of mind-body practices that back when I started, and, you know, I would say as a new therapist many, many years ago, I started doing these things because they were so transformative in my own life, but I was afraid to even talk about it with colleagues, or people would think I'm a little like way out there, or woo-woo, or kind of, you know, crazy. And now these things have become much, much more mainstream, and there's a lot of science to support a lot of this. So it's very exciting in the field to just see the evolution of all this.
Boy, who are you telling? Just most recently, I had a guest come on, talked about science empowerment, and just thinking about the work that science has eclipsed in mental health, writing formulas that we can formulate to ourselves to go from a negative standpoint to feeling a little more positive. And it's more similar to the work that you lent to, which I'm dying for our listeners to kind of learn about. Let's talk a little bit about your book. You don't have to change everything. 6 ways to shift your vantage point, stop striving for happy, and find true well-being. Tell us about this.
Where to start? So, you know, like I had shared, this book really came, I started doing the brunt of the writing for it during the pandemic. And at that time, and I'm thinking, you know, part of the subtitle of the book, so I'll just sort of share a little piece that, you know, I started writing the book, I think during the height of the pandemic, a lot of the lockdown. So there was a lot of fear. There was a lot of anxiety. There was a lot of uncertainty that we were all grappling with. And sort of interesting as a psychologist to be sitting with my patients, and we were all dealing with the same collective fears, which is unusual, you know, to have that kind of experience. But So that was really kind of a starting point for writing this book. And then fast forward to kind of losing track of how many years in, but the Omicron virus that, you know, that kind of reemergence. There was a point where I found myself feeling like, okay, finally we're coming up for air. And then it was like, oh, wait, here's this whole other unknown. What's going to happen with this variant? And I found myself in a funk. Mm-hmm. And I was, you know, I was really sort of struggling a bit at that point. And what I found just in terms of my own internal dialogue was, okay, I miss some of the happiness that I, you know, like, yeah, I'm not feeling like really happy right now. This is not a happy time. And yet what was important for me and what I really came to is this, you know, how that nonetheless, even though I might feel fear and uncertainty, anxiety, all this, how could I nonetheless still find well-being? Mm. And how could I continue to cultivate that for myself and for my patients and my clients? And so this idea that I think, and I speak for the culture kind of where I grew up here, mm-hmm. that I here as in New England, kind of where I've pretty much spent my life, most of my life, that there's a bit of a striving for happiness, I think, which, by the way, I wish for all of us. I hope I wish all of us feel that as much as we can in our lives. But what happens the rest of the time? What do we do then? And what do we do when we come up against more difficult emotions, which are really part of our daily life? So how do we find well-being that can support us even when happiness may not be there at every moment, you know, because at least as happiness is, again, typically defined in our culture, this idea of, you know, when X happens, then I feel happy, or, it, you know, so it tends to be dependent on certain circumstances and certain mood, you know, I have to be in a particular mood to feel happiness, whereas well-being is something that, you know, I could feel sad. I mean, even in the midst of grieving at times, I could think if there are times where there can be a deep sense of well-being, nonetheless, of feeling supported, for example, by others, you know, around you and not feeling alone in the midst of that. So anyway, I guess I'm giving you a little bit of the background of some of where this, you know, book grew out of and some of those concepts that I began to really grapple with and write about.
You know, again, I'm going to go back into that side of you. I know the clients that you support, the colleagues that you work with, and the people that you've touched through your talks are very fortunate to have a person who is genuine, such as yourself. A lot of times we can say to ourselves, well, look, I've written 3 books already. This is nothing. I could just sit up here and write the book just to write it. But it didn't sit well with you. And that says something to the practice, to your craft, and to the people who are going to respond and receive your work. Mm. You know, many a times we are caught up in the, you know, I'm Dr. Beth Curlin and I've been here, I've been there. To you, there's always, and it sounds like to me, even though that I'm in this state, I want to give you the best that I have at all times. And now let's reference the 6 vantage points, which I thought were fascinating. The anchor, the child view, the audience view, the compassionate parent view, the mirror view, the ocean view. Tell us about this.
Okay. So I guess starting with the anchor view, and I'll just give a little background to say that. So what's interesting is I've been reflecting on this recently. I feel like many of us know more about our cars than we do about what's under the hood here. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I share about in the book, and I'm a bit of a, I don't know, you know, let's say I'm fascinated by neuroscience and all of that stuff, and, you know, really understanding some of the biology and all of that, that it is really helpful to understand a little bit about our autonomic nervous system. And how that plays a role in everything that we do. And so in essence, and I'm simplifying things a bit here, mm-hmm. but we kind of have what I like to think of as this old operating system and a newer operating system. And our old operating system was wired in through millions of years of evolution to help our ancestors survive. Mm-hmm. And so we have these protection circuits if you will. And how that shows up in our modern lives is, you know, our kind of our fight, flight, freeze response, mm-hmm. But our classic stress response.
Mm-hmm.
So we can, when we encounter challenges in our lives, we, you know, our stress response gets turned on. We have resources that get us charged up. It might show up as, you know, fear, anxiety, anger, irritability, frustration, that kind of thing often in our modern lives. But it's our body, you know, giving us energy to try to deal with whatever this perceived threat is. Mm-hmm. Sometimes part of that protection circuitry can also put us more in a shutdown mode. Mm. It can put us into, you know, a little bit of that collapse, withdrawal, shutdown, procrastinate,
mm-hmm.
avoid. And these are part of our adaptive circuitry, but we also have this newer operating system that when our nervous system is in balance, when there's more regulation, when there's more cues of safety that we can bring in for to our nervous system, we have access to a whole different set of resources that can help us meet our challenges.
Mm.
We have access to compassion and self-compassion and curiosity and creativity and perspective and problem solving and care and you know, all of these and connection, which is so important.
Mm-hmm.
So all of this, I know I'm giving kind of a long background. The anchor view is all about, so when we face challenges in our lives, often our old operating system kicks in. We kind of can go into some of those protection modes. Mm-hmm. I don't know, think about it, you know, just even getting into an argument with somebody, right? We get into the fight response that can be sometimes this reactive place where we go to.
Mm-hmm.
If we can understand that that's just our nervous system trying to protect us and keep us safe,
mm-hmm.
and we can also have ways of bringing more cues of safety into our nervous system, starting at the level, like really in the body,
mm-hmm.
To help bring some balance into, you know, what we're feeling, then that balance can help us to kick on or switch into our newer operating system where we can see a bigger picture.
Mm.
And so I'm not talking about anything too fancy and complicated here. You know, it's as basic as understanding how our breath works.
Mm-hmm.
It's as basic as, so, and the idea of the anchor view is how do we anchor ourselves in the middle of a storm? So we tend to, you know, we come up against strong emotions in the course of our day, of our week.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're out in the ocean swimming and a big storm whips up, you know, if we try to fight against it,
mm-hmm.
get, you know, that's going to exhaust our resources. If we get swept away by that storm, that's not going to be great. Mm-hmm. But if we grab onto an anchor, a ship that's safely anchored in the harbor, we can grab, hold on to that anchor, then we can, the storm is still there. We don't necessarily have control about stopping that storm, but we can watch from a safe vantage point. And we could watch that storm and we have a sense that somehow we are okay amidst that.
That's fascinating. Fascinating. And, you know, just to interject a bit, and we'll get into the other pieces to follow through, what I started making a connection with, even you, myself, and other people who have to stand up in front of crowds, that anchor view comes up, right?
Yeah.
You know you have to perform, but there are times that although you're the expert, you're the so-called person that knows what you're going to present, you've practiced your lines or you memorize your work or whatever it is, you feel something. There's a connection that you feel when the lights click on. Maybe the computer isn't working right. The slide deck got messed up. Mm-hmm. What are you going to do now? So in the midst of that, the crowd is still expecting you to perform. And I'm going to reference a past guest, Dr. Danny Slomoff, the myth of public speaking in this aspect. If I were to use the anchor view, I'm not going to concentrate on 1,000 people that are in the crowd. I'll concentrate on one person.
Mm-hmm.
Now look at that one person and make that connection. And
love
that's
it.
What I was thinking when you were speaking about, if I'm put up in a situation that A, I can't run from and I have to perform, is either I can freeze and forget my lines, get nervous, stutter, mm-hmm. something, or I can anchor myself, find a way to breathe,
yes.
ground myself to move towards success. And usually when you have that internal connection, meaning that you care about what you're doing, mm-hmm. that usually pops up. And I thought that that was great. Thank you so much. Let's talk about the child view.
Yeah, I love what you shared, by the way. That's great. And I think it can be helpful to just be able to kind of name that when mm-hmm. that's happening. And just to say, oh, okay, this is part of my, you know, survival wiring, just trying to protect me, getting my heart rate going, getting my, you know, and you know, when I do public speaking, I feel that, you know, but then being able to accept and embrace that and have ways of grounding ourselves, and, you know, right through some of these mind-body practices. So, yeah.
Thank you about that, Dr. Curlin. But for me, it's more about what I said about you thus far, what our listeners have gained. You're compassionate about your work. You're dedicated to this work. Mm-hmm. And in talks that I've seen you perform, and I've also now had the opportunity to have this book, there's a piece of you that you have to make a connection in order for this to work. And we got a lot of respect for you for that. Thank mm-hmm. you Thank so you. Much for that. Let's talk about the child view, because I was interested about this vantage point.
Yeah. Yeah. So once we can anchor ourselves, once we bring a little bit of stability into this, right? We think about, we have these inner disturbances under the hood, you know, mm-hmm. that happen in, you know, in and out every day of our lives in some way. So we anchor ourselves. That's our first move to kind of help bring a little more grounding and regulation into the system, right? And then the child view is all about really cultivating this qualities that young children have. And one of the qualities that young children have, if you watch even babies, it's quite fun to watch, you know, a baby with just an ordinary object, right? That there's a kind of curiosity that they will, you know, grasp and hold and look at and explore with that. And so what I found that can be really helpful, that when we are going through our lives, we tend to be on automatic pilot a lot of the time. And that's part of our wiring too. That's, you know, part of how we're wired. But when we can begin to bring curiosity toward what's happening, what's coming up, we can bring curiosity towards our emotions, our physical sensations in our bodies, our thoughts, our behaviors, and really start to notice it with that kind of a curious leaning in, because I think curiosity has a non-judgmental piece to it. Mm-hmm. And it's really, it's the first step of cultivating mindful awareness, is mm-hmm. Being able to get curious about, okay, what's actually happening here? Because when we can bring that curiosity and childlike quality to what's happening, we have more choice. So for example, just to make this make a little more sense, you know, I could be in a situation where, I don't know, I'm standing in the grocery store, you know, in a long line or something, and getting really frustrated, and I'm caught in that frustration, you know, and we can get in our heads and we can, you know, and if I can remember to, I like to think about it as stop, drop, and get curious. Mm. So the stop, like a little bit of a pause, drop into the body. What's happening in here? And then get curious, like, oh, wow, you know, I could see my breath is getting really constricted. I'm all tight inside. I'm, you know, starting to tell myself all these stories about, oh my God, I'm not going to have enough time to do this and that. Then I can begin to see the ways that I'm, you know, creating added suffering for myself in that moment, right? And moving myself away from well-being. And in the seeing of that, there's more possibility. There's the possibility to take a breath, to relax, to look around me, to connect with the person behind me, you know, to recognize that I'm not the only person maybe waiting there in that. In that pausing, there's an opportunity for a little bit more ease to come into the system. Mm. So that's just one, you know, little example. But I also love with children, there's a playfulness. that children have. There's these, you know, qualities of interest and friendliness and playfulness. And so when we can cultivate some of those qualities, they can be really helpful alongside of us dealing with, you know, our daily challenges, which we can take ourselves pretty seriously and sometimes even too seriously, I think.
You know what? I cannot wait to finish reading the book, and I plan to have the link on my website so people can take advantage as we discuss the other vantage points. You forgot to mention that kids tell the truth and they're truth seekers. Boy, nobody tells the truth like these kids. And they seek the truth, asking you all type of questions. But I loved how you talked about how to interconnect within us. And I think that that pureness from that child view, from that child standpoint, there's nothing more pure. Whenever we're thinking about a negative thought, or sometimes we're struggling to feel positive, I've also worked with clients, letting them remember when was a happy moment. And many a times they've either, if they had a great childhood, go back to the when I was growing up, and this these were the things that we did. So yes, that child view really lends to so much. But for me is, how do we interconnect that? How is that laced within us with our own authentic selves? And I really love that. Thank you so much about that. Is there a way that you can help us understand, and this was real cool, survival wiring versus thriving wiring?
Yeah, so that was a little bit of what I was talking about with the autonomic nervous system. And this idea that we, first and foremost, are wired to survive. And one of the things that helped our ancestors survive was to be able to fight or flee from that saber-toothed tiger, from that, you know, external physical threat. And so, you know, our heart rate goes up, our blood pressure goes up, the blood, you know, stress chemicals get released into the body as part of this protective response. Or sometimes, you know, animals will play dead. We don't do that as human beings typically, but we have that protective shutdown valve. And we can, and that can sort of make us pull, you know, pull into our shell as a way. And sometimes we need to do that, you know, in our lives at moments. But we can also get stuck in this survival wire. And I'll talk about for myself. I know that I tend to be wired kind of more on the type A, if you will, high stress mode, you know, and the anxious mode. And so to me, that is part of my survival wiring, or my ancestor survival wiring, that's passed down to, you know, right into my genes. And if I'm not paying attention otherwise, I can go through the day and just feel like this high pressure and high stress, and oh my gosh, I gotta get everything done, and overwhelm. And that's my survival wiring that's kind of active in those moments, right? But we also have this, you know, what I call this thriving wiring, which is that when the body perceives enough cues of safety, we have all of these other resources that become available to us. And some of those things that I was saying, like compassion and self-compassion and creativity and perspective and problem solving and care and connection and confidence, all those things that when, you know, when we're feeling enough of those cues of safety, really from a nervous system level, you know, we can tap into that. And so each of these vantage points helps to bring some of those cues of safety in. When we can approach the, you know, we can grab that anchor, we feel more sense of safety. When we begin to like be able to look curiously towards what's happening and what's here, that non-judgmental curiosity helps us lean in a little bit. And that can help us see things more clearly. So each of these vantage points is really helping us tap into some of this newer, you know, thriving wiring, if you will, as I think about it.
You know, I'm going to go back to reflect on, you may have answered the first time, but now the second time, I lent it more to some child view in it, almost like there was some innocence about this. I may have to shut down just to auto protect. I may not know all of the answers. Mm-hmm. So it gave me the sense of survival in a different way. So that was very interesting. Mm. Kind of the same concept, but now that you explained it this way, knowing that I knew the second vantage point, it's really beautiful how it's so applicable in so many different ways, depending on how you can make this work. And you kind of modeled and said, I may have the type A, but still, this is how I work. And when I have to perform, this is how I go at it.
Yeah. And being able to bring, you know, again, just with that child view, when I can, like, I start walking around saying, oh my God, I have so much to do and get caught in that. If I could bring that child view, that curiosity, say, oh, isn't this interesting? Look at how Beth is kind of getting all tense and contracted and constricted. And just that curiosity reminds me that, okay, wait, you know, there's no lions chasing me. There's no tigers chasing me in this moment. And so, you know, how can I like bring in a little bit more safety into the nervous system to be able to just, you know, take that sigh to put things in some perspective. But just that shifting the vantage point kind of helps see things from a different place.
I'm going to follow that up now, shifting, right? This is something that I captured learning from you in one of the talks that I saw you do. You know, if we were to change our viewpoints, we don't have to worry about changing ourselves.
Yeah, yeah.
A little bit about that, Dr. Curlman.
Yeah, and that is actually, I mean, the whole essence of the title of the book, you don't have to change everything, that I think so many of us, and I know I've experienced this in my lifetime, so many people that I sit with have this sense of, there's something wrong, something missing, you know, I'm not enough. Mm. And we come from that. We often can go through our lives as what I call the whole self, H-O-L-E. Mm. Feeling like there's something missing, there's a hole, you know. And when we can instead, I think, recognize that we have all of these resources within us, sometimes we just need to learn how to tap into them. Mm. And so it's not about changing or fixing ourselves or even changing how we feel, but it's about just being able to see, to really relate to our inner experiences in a different way, to change our relationship to what's coming up so that we're not pushing it away. We're not getting swallowed up in it, but we can allow it to be there, and we can be present to our own emotions, whatever they might be. And so when we change our relationship to however we relate in this way, we don't have to change ourselves, but things begin to change. Mm. And as we get access to more of that newer operating system or that thriving wiring, things change, because there are these resources that are now at our disposal that we have within us. We may forget that we have, we may forget that are there.
You know, now I'm going to tap into, even though that you're a superhero, a great writer, you've done so much. Tell me a little bit about your dad and how has he played a role of this for you in this work that you do?
Hmm. So I think the first word when you brought up my dad, the first word that comes to my mind is resilient, you know, and I don't think I could have had the perspective to appreciate at the time when, you know, I'm thinking back. So there were myself and two siblings when my mom died, you know, I was 15. And so he had three kids, you know, that he was then essentially raising and trying to figure out how to move through life and all of that. And I'm very fortunate to still have my dad in my life at this time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I see his resilience, the way that he's faced lots of different challenges, some health challenges over more recent years, with just this incredible capacity to meet himself where he is, to work with what's there, and also to continue to move forward and to look for what's there, that what's supportive for him. In the TED talk that I did, you know, I share this story, and I won't go into the whole story, but it's something that really stands out for me that my dad shared with me. But this idea that we can look for, you know, what's wrong, what's missing, right? There's two wrong notes this famous, piano player, you know, made these two wrong notes, and we can focus on those two wrong notes, or we can focus on, you know, like the rest of the beautiful performance. And I think my dad really moves through life like that, really looking at, even, okay, there are these losses, there are these things, there's even challenges with his health, but what do I have? What can I really strengthen, and just moving forward from there. So he's an inspiration for me in that way.
You know, shout out to dad, and shout out to all the positive men who are making a difference out here, showing with resilience. This was the grabber for me when I got to see your talk. Mm-hmm. That connection that you made, because usually, as you referenced the piano player, one is always to remember the last thing that happened, or usually the negative piece about that. Oh, that was great, but did you notice this and this and that? And seldom do we see an opportunity where someone is able to focus, but did you see the performance, enjoyment that took place, how it made others feel? People even forgot that even happened. So shout out to that resilience and that viewpoint, and shout out to dad, of course.
You know, and I would jump in to say that, so one of my viewpoints I call the mirror view. Mm-hmm. It's really kind of segueing off of this idea of, often when we look in the mirror, we see what's wrong, you know, either in the physical mirror sometimes, but in the metaphorical mirror too, right? Mm-hmm. And we can find all these things that are wrong with us, and we're not doing well, and, you know, this with this and that. We can be quite, you know, our own worst critics often. Mm-hmm. And we have this negativity bias of our brain that predisposes us in some way to, you know, it helped our ancestors survive to see what was wrong and what was lurking where, you know, tigers lurking there, not necessarily sitting around smelling the roses or finding the good, you know, because they needed to, you know, survive and be on the lookout for all those negatives. We do that within ourselves. But the mirror view is all about holding up a mirror, and what would shift or change if we were able to, if that mirror could reflect back to us our strengths. And this circles back to my mentor, Robert Brooks, during my internship, that what was so transformative at that time was that he taught us how to help people, help to see each person's island of competence, as he called it. And he actually, you would appreciate this with the work that you do, I think, you know, he worked in school systems at that time, working with some of these, you know, who were kind of categorized as really difficult kids, acting out and, you know, having all kinds of behavior problems. And what he would do is go in there and not try to fix those behavior problems, but he would try to find that kid's strength. What was the thing that kid did could do well, or how could he elevate that and strengthen that? And that's where true change lives. And so when we can use this mirror view for ourselves and look in the mirror and begin to find our own strengths and what already resides inside us and the qualities that we have that we can draw upon to help us, you know, even amidst our challenges, things really begin to change.
You know, you touched a chord, obviously, there when you reference children, because when you're working with kids, finding what works for them, whether it's a student with an IEP, a regular ed student, you're thinking about that vantage point for them. Where does their intelligence, where does their genius live? And I loved how you referenced, and it had me thinking about project-based learning, or enrichment? What are the things that the kid can bring out in their work without having to do the typical way of learning? There's many students who we know, and even adults, who weren't cut out to be in school for like standardized based testing and doing these things. They were more cut out to display their greatness and to display the ways that they understand the work. So that was beautiful. Thank you for that.
Yeah. And if teachers or if parents or if employers, right, if we can find the greatness in others and hold up a mirror and reflect it back to them, how powerful is that? You know, and if we can do that for ourselves, then we, you know, can take all those inner strengths that we already have that we just may not be seeing or appreciating, and we can really use it and bring that into different areas of our life.
Mm. You know, about your book, without giving out too much, can you give us some tips or something that we can find within your book that our listeners can benefit from who are listening to this show?
Well, here's a little thing I'll share. And there's so many different things. So I will say that the fun thing for me about this book is that it wove a lot of personal story, a lot of psychology, but also mind-body practices and practical things that people can do in their lives. And I also, I guess as a side note, recorded, there's a lot of audio meditations that accompany the book that people can access. But what came to my mind was just an exercise that I have called the buckets of well-being. And I thought of this came to me during the pandemic, again, kind of seeing myself and many people struggling at that time. And even when we weren't necessarily feeling happy all the time, and even with all the restrictions at that time too, but this idea that we all have buckets of well-being, many different kinds of buckets. And so the first step is identifying what are those buckets that each of us individually have. What are the things that if we fill that bucket, even a little tiny bit, brings us some well-being? For example, for some people, you know, being in connection with others is a really important bucket of well-being. And that could look all kinds of different ways, picking up the phone and calling a friend, you know, getting together with somebody, you know, all connecting in a community. Okay, so that another bucket of well-being might be creative expression. For some people, when they can tap into their creative expression, they can experience, you know, really connect in with that sense of well-being, whether it's, my husband became a great creative cook during the pandemic. But, you know, for somebody who it could be art, it could be any, but finding your voice, right? Whatever that expression is. Another bucket of well-being might be learning something new. Some people, for them, when they learn something new, that really gives them a sense of well-being, right? So all these, being in nature, moving our bodies, coming up with thinking about reflecting on what are the things that really bring me well-being. And then just each day kind of waking up and saying, what's one drop of, you know, that I could put into one of my buckets? And, you know, sometimes for me, if I'm having a down day, it's just like, I'm going to go for a short walk out in the woods in nature, because I know that that is one drop in that bucket of well-being that's going to help support me that day. So anyway, that's just a little.
No, that was actually beautiful. I wanted to follow that up by just saying, everyone get your buckets out, like fill these up, because it is necessary to find the goods in what we do, whether little or small or big achievement. These buckets need to be filled, and we need to find ways to do that. I can't help but ask you, and I know that you do a lot of well-being and meditation and all this work. Let's talk about spirituality, whether it's around religion or just finding your holistic self. What do you use most to create all of the creative work that you've done? What aims you the best? Is it meditation? Is it breathing? Is it taking these walks? Is it just deep reflection and thought? Is it loss? Help us understand.
Wow. I think in some ways it's all of that. You know, it's interesting that you bring up this idea of spirituality, because the ocean view, that the, which is the last view that I talk about in my book, really touches into this. And interestingly, we can become disconnected from that. There's a woman, Lisa Miller, who writes about how as kids, we're all born with this kind of connection with our spirituality, and we often get disconnected from that as we get older. But that could look, but this idea of having meaning and purpose, and feeling some connection with something larger than us. Mm. And so I remember when I heard a sermon given by my rabbi many years ago, when, oh gosh, I was a teenager at the time, and he was quoting William James, who happens to be the father of psychology, and it was something like, and I may be misquoting this exactly, but the greatest thing we could do with our lives is to spend it on something that will outlast it. Mm. So I think for me, that really struck me, you know, even at that young age or whatever. And so I think my meaning and purpose, when I can connect in with somehow feeling like I'm doing something that is beyond me, that connects me with other people around me, that connects me with this whole common humanity that we're all swimming in the ocean of, right? We think we're that isolated wave, but we're really just part of this whole collective ocean. Mm. And so I think that's where my spirituality lives, in being able to feel like I can connect and give and be part of something much bigger than myself.
Dynamite. I mean, I'm just thinking, visualizing as you're speaking, you have this ability to speak and someone can concentrate and think about and view this. It's amazing to think that the work that you've done throughout the years is just a big ocean, and you're sometimes aiming it towards the right side of the ocean, sometimes the center, sometimes a different angle. So thank you for letting us in on that side of you that is your creative side, if you will.
Yeah.
I wanted to touch base on this because I know that in doing this work and based on all the things I've shared about your humanistic side, if you will, there always is a story, or there are clients, or there's someone who draws you more into this work. Have you been, whether it's a mentor, whether it's a patient, whether a client, a colleague, has there been someone who has touched your life enough to remind you of maybe a downfall, a struggle that they had, and now you use that to motivate, to anchor yourself, if you will, to get to that next spot, to get better, because that fight that they had is the one that keeps reminding you, I have more work to do.
Mm. Wow. There's a lot in that question. And I don't, my mind is going to a lot of individual people that I know, but I think, you know, there's just this collective sense. I think what I'm most struck by, as, you know, again, I feel like it is such a privilege truly to be in the career that I'm at, sitting with people who entrust me with, you know, so much of their personal lives. And I think what I'm most struck with is just the absolute resilience of the human spirit. You know, that I've sat with people from all walks of life through all kinds of challenges and suffering, from loss to health challenges to divorce to, you know, conflicts in families and trauma and all kinds of things. But I think what unites us all is just this tremendous resilience that is there within us, if we can sometimes just have the right support to kind around us to bring that out in us. And so I'm so inspired by, I don't know, I think it'd be hard to pick any one person, but I feel like I've been so inspired by all of my patients and, you know, clients over the years, really of all different ages. I mean, some kids, you know, who are, you know, just unbelievably, like, this wisdom comes out when they feel safe and connected. And so, not that, sure that answered the question, but.
No, it did, actually. It just, again, just reiterates once again, you know, you're flawless in this work. You're pulled into it because you're drawn for the greater good. It's not more about the result or what you've put in. Is my new idea going to work the best? You're really concentrated on the entire role, the wholeness. And this time, whole is W.
Mm-hmm. That's it, exactly.
So for me to listen to you, obviously, I'm a fan, and I'm a fan of your work, obviously, because of how you're able to blend in the realness of what someone who needs or seeks your services would want. They definitely would not want a person who would be here not vested in what it is. And I think that you've answered that beautifully. And it's just been a total pleasure having you. And once again, as you well know, I will continue to put in practice as much as I've learned today. And I'm sure that my listeners who've also listened to our show will be able to do the same. Before we let you go, the floor is yours. Is there anything you want to leave us with? Words of encouragement, empowerment, if you will, for our listeners?
I think the first thing that comes to mind is I just hope that people can walk away with some message of, you know, that you're not alone, that we just have this shared common humanity, that we are all human, that we all struggle, and that ultimately, you know, we are there to support each other too. And so I think just finding whatever ways people can of that kind of connection and support in their lives. And I guess I would put a little plug in only because I know there's a stigma around this to some degree, but, and obviously I'm biased as, you know, in terms of psychologists and so forth, but hoping that people would never hesitate to reach out for help and, you know, in terms of professional help and seeking therapy for, you know, in there, wherever they live and so forth, if they need it, because I know that, you know, many people, this is a challenging time for many people. There's a lot going on in our world and a lot, you know, that people are and dealing with. So I guess like to put that out there as well. And just knowing that, you know, I heard a neuroscientist, Richard Davidson, I love his research. He said something to the effect of that well-being is essentially a skill. Like, it's no different than learning to play the cello. Now, I don't play the cello, and that may take a bit of practice, but I think that just knowing that well-being is something, it really is a skill that we can cultivate. And there are things that we can do each day, even if it's just that one drop in a bucket somewhere, right, to build that well of well-being inside of us. And I wrote this book with the hope that I will give people tools and ways to be able to do that. But I guess just maybe leaving on that note that well-being is really something that we can cultivate no matter what we're feeling inside, no matter what our life circumstances, something that's always there for us to draw on. And as we learn how to, you know, cultivate and strengthen that, the skill of well-being, if you will, it really becomes a tremendous strength for us.
Fabulous. And friends, let's continue to cultivate, but fear nothing, because fear is part of the process of your achievements. Your achievements will now be the fears of others who doubt you. Because on this platform, we won't be overlooked. We won't be labeled, because way too often we did that, but this is no longer. Our plight and our fight is for anyone and everyone who feels a need to be understood. We are strong as individuals, but unstoppable when we unite. Tune in, friends, to another He's Just a Social Worker show. Coming to another town near you real soon. We out.
Please note that the views expressed here are my own and not a representation of my employers and clients. Thank you for listening. We're always here for you. Just message us and we'll get back to you within 24 hours. Thank you. More than just at He's Just a Social Worker.